Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Mike Shapiro on turning around a Southern California real estate brokerage. I'm Dan Breslin, host of the REI Diamond Show, and today I am interviewing Mike Shapiro, who is the chairman of Home Sotheby's International Realty in Southern California. With a background in stock trading, Mike purchased a bankrupt real estate brokerage in 2009 and built it into the leading brand in the Newport Beach, California market through great marketing, great branding, and great management. In this episode, Mike reveals the strategy and management style that he used to take this failing 36-agent brokerage into a leading 400-agent international brokerage with average listing prices of $2 million and up, and some of the highest producing real estate agent teams in the entire United States. Well, we might as well get right into it, eh? All right. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I know you're a big deal, and a lot of people know you're a big deal. But for those of the listeners who don't know who Mike Shapiro is, could you give us a little bit of the background, the origination story, kind of what you did before real estate, how you got into real estate, and then a snapshot of what your business looks like currently?
Okay, well, there is a long one version and a short version, so I'm not sure how much your audience wants me to bore them. But I was not in real estate. My career was as a stock options trader on the floors in Chicago. So I was a market maker, and I basically, you know, when somebody needed a stock option specific to Merck Pharmaceuticals or to Raytheon was in my pit, I think Starbucks was in my pit. That's what I did for a living for many, many years. My wife and myself had met one another in Arizona. That's where we went to Arizona State University, and we thought our fortunes lied in Chicago, and we lived there for many years. And ironically speaking, while I was a trader on the floor, my wife became a realtor for a company called Coldwell Banker, a small company, right? And she subsequently became the number one real estate agent in the city of Chicago for Coldwell Banker. So I had some experience living with that business, which would someday come back to me in regard to how I eventually got into this business. So let's fast forward. Became, without coming off rude, became successful early in life. It enabled us to move where we wanted to move, and we eventually ended up in Newport Beach, retired relatively early in life, in my early 40s. I was in a really bad place in regard to not doing anything. Newport Beach is an interesting spot for your listeners. I don't know how many of them are from here or in this general area, but it's a fascinating place where I wonder how many people actually work here sometimes. When I wasn't working, I was walking around finding all these people not working, which was kind of funny. And it was terrible for me. I hated it. And subsequently, I went into, with a friend of mine, a venture capital firm where I wanted to make investments. I really wanted to get back to work. So not being a very good venture capitalist, my friend and I were probably the worst venture capitalists in history. One of the deals that came across the table at the time, this is about 9 years ago, was a friend of mine from Arizona, and this would have been in 07, early 07, had a successful mortgage business, and he had taken his fortune that he made in that, and he put it into a real estate company, and obviously the timing was horrific for him. The writing was on the wall. Of course, ground central for the real estate disaster of 08 was, you know, the Nevada, Arizona, some of these southwestern states, I think, we can all say that. I mean, it happened nationally, but some of the worst areas of the country hit were some of those trade areas. So he wanted capital to open up a real estate office to soften some of the seasonality that he had and also to withstand what he saw as a potential collapse to open an office in Newport Beach. I, just being a venture capitalist, went to my real estate agent and asked her some questions locally. I mean, I had been familiar with the real estate business from years prior, and in a different trade area, I think. And I'll get to what I think of this trade area in a few moments, but it's very different selling real estate in Chicago. It's different motivations and different mentality than there is in selling in some of the luxury markets in the West or even in the New York City area. So subsequently, I spoke with a real estate agent, and she told me that this specific trade area was almost very inclusive. It almost was like a fraternity sorority at the time, and that it didn't matter how much capital you threw at it. It was almost like being an insider, and that would be the only way to succeed in terms of recruiting the top agents. So she suggested I speak with the company that she was with, and they were failing because they didn't have enough capital in 07, called Home Group. And I spoke with them, and I listened to the pitch, and you know, I said, would you want me to effectively help you manage this crisis? And then I tried to act as an investment banker and merge the two companies between Arizona and California, thinking that there would be a synergy and that it was a smart move under a boutique brand. And the cultures of the two companies were so vastly different that it was an impossible task. At that point, Home Group, which has had one office in Newport Beach, was about almost bankrupt. And they said, you know, either Mike, do you want to do this deal or not? I got to know the original owners, and there were 36 agents at the time and, excuse me, $200 million in sales, which may seem like a lot on a national basis, but on a local basis, it's relatively minor. The average price home here is roughly in this specific trade area is roughly $2 million or $2.2 million. And our average list price now at this point in this office is $4.5 million. So to give you an idea of the magnitude of the transactions. They were going to, you know, go out of business, so I made the investment, which is relatively minor. In capital terms, it's called recapitalization, effectively reducing their share of the business, and then I own the majority of the business, and then gave them a loan. What's funny about this is that they didn't know, nor did I know, what I really was going to do here other than they needed capital. So, you know, I think that there was some level of thought process that I was going to help them from a business structure point of view. So I really had nothing to do, because that sounds. I just showed up every day. I literally, and this is, we closed on the business in March of 08. And if I want to refresh everyone's history, people probably don't want to be refreshed in history here. But
yeah, true
September
enough.
08 would, yes. September 08 would have probably been the maximum crisis date, which is the failure, in my opinion, of Lehman Brothers, which, of course, you know, there was potential economic collapse in the U.S. That's when everyone was scrambling. So I closed probably about 6 months early, as they say, picking a bottom. And I was in a unique position in the real estate business here where I had capital to spend. I was also in a unique position and experience where I was a trader. So, you know, traders, as they say, are always the ones to understand, you know, crisis is the biggest opportunity. I always say, like, funny things like this to people. You know, it can take a lifetime or decades to make a great fortune, and it can be unwound in 10 minutes. But those 10 minutes are probably the most valuable time in anyone's history, and a great fortune can be made in 10 minutes. So that short crisis time, which a trader's mentality is the greatest thing that ever happened, which most people are scared of living crap out of. I'll keep my language somewhat cleaner than probably normally would say. I was just uniquely situated as being this person who understood capital, and I didn't see sort of a anarchy, which I think a lot of people go into business, you know, they panic. You know, there are all these little things on the floor. I'm sorry to use them here in this context, but, you know, like they rattle the cage to get in and they rattle to get out. And there's all these little silly things. But that was a great opportunity. So I came in. I really had nothing to do. I saw upon walking into the business, and I wasn't even aware of it, the real estate business, which is sort of a consignment business. And I thought to myself, well, this is a really interesting business because I can have billions of dollars of inventory and I don't have to pay for it. I mean, obviously there are expenses in being in the real estate business, but I don't have to pay for the inventory. So I thought this is a great business. And I also saw something upon entering the business during this crisis period that people, because I came from financial world, people were looking at the real estate ads as almost the stock pages. They were sort of appraising their net worth based on what their house was worth. They were making decisions based on that. And I think there are very few markets in the country that behave this way. And I think that I was aware of that. Some people talk about somewhere between 7 and 12 markets that behave where the asset of real estate is behaving very similarly to any investment. I hope I'm making myself clear. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, that's where you're going.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, like Aspen, Colorado, Manhattan, South Florida behaves like Southern California. Northern California behaves like Southern California. There are probably 7 to 12 luxury markets where there's such absurd levels of income and also absurd levels of capital necessary to purchase these properties that it takes on a different relationship to one's net worth. So I just understood something coming from a different world. It opened it up for me to change the dynamics. So I don't want to bore everybody. I don't know if you want to go to the next question, but I mean, basically by doing this, it enabled me to take this company from 36 people to practically 400 and to roughly $2.5 billion in sales relatively rapidly.
All right. So you took a company. This is all in the same market that you were describing here as the old boys network that you had to be plugged in. So who are the buyers in this price point? I mean, are we talking about people who have absentee second homes? Is this, you know, owner occupied 90% of the year? Who's the typical buyer for some of these higher dollar, $2 million and up properties that you guys represent?
Well, obviously, the buyers are as diverse as in any trade area. I mean, because it is in the Los Angeles metropolitan area, for lack of a description, we probably have anywhere between 20 and 30% of the business is foreign nationals. It is difficult for me to tell you what does that mean because I can't, in the existing structure, I don't know if they are citizens or not of the, you know, I'm making a guesstimate on, you know, these are people not originally from this country, and I don't want to cross any lines here, but that's really what it was. And the majority of that was from Asia, although we do have some European traffic. So there was Japanese money and Chinese money that was, you know, I'd say a good 30% of the business. Other than that, is second home traffic, because it's a beach area, is significant. It's probably another third of the business, second, third, fourth, or fifth home traffic. And then another third of the business, I would say, is just people moving around or up or moving in for jobs or, you know, the Newport Beach is a center point for a tremendous amount of financial industry and even real estate industry. So there's a lot of that kind of traffic.
Got it. You mentioned that people were basing their net worth on real estate values, looking at the newspaper and really kind of like viewing that, I guess, the same way they would view their securities and their portfolio. Is that sort of where you were going with that, Mike?
Yes, that's exactly where I was going with that. I think that they were literally looking at the securities in the portfolio, and they were making buying decisions or financial decisions based on where their home was. So that the magnitude, the almost like the real estate office in this trade area acted like a trading floor. I was back on the trading floor. At the time I traded in Chicago, it was the center point at that time of the financial in city of Chicago. You felt like you were, you know, part of the process of the whole city. And in a weird sort of way, it's similar in these large brokerages and these types of trade areas where you're hearing everything and what's going on, and you're getting a general sense of the economics in the general area. It is really interesting. It continues to behave that way. In fact, Todd and I, and you know Todd, who has an advanced degree in economics, I've said for years that there were correlations between certain financials, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, for example, which is, you know, the top 30, arguably the top 30 most important stocks in this country, these multinational corporations, and actually behavior of the existing equity in the homes here. And so we did a study recently, actually we're finishing it off, where the correlations are extraordinary. I mean, well into the 90s, that was correct, and we're going back years. So this is something that we're going to publish and put out to our existing agents and also their clients. So, you know, I constantly strive to differentiate myself as a company to maintain the markets that we have. I constantly look to do things that are different than our competitors. And it's part of the reason that I'm successful, and I translate the things that I've done in my background and all of the things that I've done and made me successful into coaching a lot of these agents here and the company in general on, you know, how do you become successful in this business environment, which is becoming so hyper-competitive. And I have always said, you know, that business is always dynamic, and, you know, it's fascinating to see how dynamic it is. And I think that we've entered another period where things have changed again. And how do you become successful in another iteration of the business world? I mean, it's fascinating to me, associated with, you know, sometimes I've attended these lectures on the dynamic changes of the way people communicate and like businesses that didn't even exist 10 years ago. So I attended this lecture. It impacted me as a famous company, name eludes me right now, out of New York, that does these sort of analysis of you know, trend lines in business and social media and things like that. And he just stood up and he said, you know, 15 years ago, for example, there was an agent and a house, and that's all there was. And now today, there's an agent, and there's like 100 different things going on between the agent and the house, but ironically speaking, it's still an agent and a house, such as social media, such as Zillow, such as Trulia, Redfin. I mean, there's all of these things coming out. And he also said in the same term, would we ever think 15 years ago that we would get into a car with a stranger? You know, Uber is taking over. Or would we ever think that we would ever stay in someone else's home that we never knew? You know, Airbnb. And so all of these things have changed. So once again, there's this change dynamic in the way people interact with one another. And so I try to coach, because being a trader from before gave you a unique ability to stay hyper-dynamic, because you are making rapid decisions during the day in order to survive. And you are reading, you know, is an old term called read the tape. And I talk about this all the time, where I would read literally the stock tape and read the news stories. And I was making decisions whether to buy or sell certain options, or buy certain options, minute to minute. Now, obviously, real estate isn't minute to minute. However, it is more than people recognize. You know, it is very much more. And so that's what I do in this whole coaching concept of, you know, and I also do it as far as, you know, when I'm coaching people, I also talk about what makes them great. I do think that everyone has their own inner genius. I really do believe that, and I know that sounds somewhat Pollyanna or, you know, corny, but I think it's like sort of coaching it out of them. What in your life have you been super successful at? And then try to apply it to sales position in real estate. So I'm sorry to keep rambling. I apologize. But that, in a nutshell, gets you.
That's cool. It's ironic to hear you, who came from a stock trading background. Myself, I'm in a unique position. So I don't know a lot of people who do the business just like I do. And we're currently in Colorado. We're in the Baltimore, Maryland, Virginia, D.C. area. We're in the Tampa Bay area in Florida. We are in the Atlanta, Georgia, Chicago area, and Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Delaware area. So I'm continuously like logging in and making those variety of decisions. And I've got like whiteboards, and I know all my positions, all my buy positions. And I know when we're selling them all, and I'm keeping track of all these deals in my head. And I imagine, even though I'm not experienced in that way, there'd be somewhat like a stock trader making all these decisions and watching all these different places. And I'm reading continuously market data and things that I'm paying attention to in every one of those markets to make sure that none of my deals get hurt. Right. And it's cool to hear you describe that the same way, and have the same mentality when it comes to brokerage as well. I just wanted to kind of point that out. So, Mike, you attracted 400 agents in a market where you were not supposed to be able to get in more than the 36 that came with the bankrupted company that you bought. What was it that allowed you, what were kind of the leverage points? What were the breakthroughs? Was there a marketing strategy? Did you have a strategy at all for attracting those agents? So maybe to kind of describe what that turnaround looked like.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. And I think that the strategy was that I was aware that marketing was clearly the most important thing at that moment in time. Now, mind you, I got a gift, and most people don't look at 2008 as a gift, but I got a gift of 2008. So no one had any capital to spend on marketing. So I immediately understood the value of a brand. And so I positioned, had meetings and positioned the company and its brand, marketing not to agents, but to the consumers. I thought it was somewhat ironic. Now, obviously, agents are the most important thing to a brokerage. That's the lifeblood, and it's the only really asset. But people seem to forget, you know, when they internalize this whole agency concept, that ultimately the person paying the freight are the consumers. And if the consumer is responding and happy, then the agents will follow. So what I did was, and I didn't really have any agents, I went directly to the consumer, and I started, you know, differentiating ourselves and marketing and creating a brand. And then I applied all of the other aspects to a brokerage, which seem relatively simple to an outsider, but for whatever reason an insider, it didn't. Like service business, you know, depending on where your trade areas are, there's money to be made on escrow, mortgages, you know, title. You know, there's different federal laws or state laws that sometimes prevent you from doing that. So that's what I did. And the second thing I did was I had a weird experience from the perspective that while my wife and I were living in Arizona when we first moved from Chicago and we had a second home here in Newport, her dream, she wasn't in the real estate business at that point, her dream was to be a retailer. So I didn't really run the company, but I weirdly was helping her with marketing, and I was attending all the advertising agencies and whatnot. So I had experience with, you know, she was competing with a company. She was a high-end women's boutique. So I had to compete against Neiman Marcus, and how did we do that? So I had a weird knowledge base on brand marketing and what to do and where to go with that. So I was just applying some things that I'd done before, you know, to do that. And then the third thing I did was agents, one of the most important things to an agent's capability is capital. I don't think that people understand the magnitude of the importance of capital to, you know, they're technically in their own businesses. You know, these real estate companies are really holding companies for the most part. But, you know, they go into it and say, I'm going to be a realtor and I'm going to make lots of money. And then they don't, like, plan out any budgets. Now, granted, you can knock on 200,000 doors and you probably make a good living and go through a lot of shoes. But in the end, from an efficiency point of view, you know, it takes capital, whether they're buying leads on Zillow, whether they're, you know, buying ads on Facebook, whether they're taking out traditional media or mailing. So what I did at that point in time, once again, I had a gift from 2008. No one had money. I started applying my capital to the top agents. So I hate to say bought agents because I didn't, but I gave them significant marketing credits. And then I had a background and an analysis of how to much money to give them in order to get a return on my investment. Now, of course, 08, you know, people are doing this today regularly. There's companies out there doing this, but there are failures at it because you cannot do it unless there's only one direction. In other words, it's like, you know, as a trader, for example, in 08-09, you could have been a monkey and bought anything equity-wise and made a fortune. It was one of the best years I've ever had in trading was in 09, you know, because I'm like, you can't go wrong. So by applying capital at that moment in time to top agents that I'd look back 3 years or 4 years, I created, you know, giant agents quickly, and it got the people started seeing what I was doing. And so we built on this sort of, you know, consumer marketing, coaching, and capitalizing top agents. And so that's where it went. And it led into about 4.5 years ago in this specific market, in order for me to, you know, it was like 4 years ago, we needed to become more international, and I was too old to do that, and that's when we joined Sotheby's, which even made a fleet frog even further for all of those resources necessary for marketing and differentiation.
What does your day-to-day look like now, Mike? So you built the company, turned it around, bought the company, turned it around. Are you active now, day-to-day? Maybe what does one of your days look like?
Yes, I'm very active day-to-day. I am active and constantly with the agents, which is a pleasure to me. I'm active in coaching agents. I'm active in helping them with all the marketing. I'm active in seeing how the future has become these teams and how to really create effective teams. You know, we're blessed in this company, and I feel part of that, to have some of the top realtors in the nation. I think we have one of them, you know, Sean Stanfield, he may be number three, two, one, I don't know, nationally. I mean, he did $525 million of business last year. You know, and I feel like I've been part of that process and applying what we understand to this team approach and to create, you know, these mega teams. You know, we have in-house, and I don't know if that's unprecedented, but I have at least five real estate agents and or teams that are doing over $100 million in business. I think that's, I mean, I don't know any other companies, you know, I look about that, and maybe in New York City, I don't know, I mean, someone's going to call in your show and say, no, I've done that. So you know, I feel like I can't, you know, hyperbole statements like that without having everything, but what I can see. So, and then the other thing that we do, what I'm doing on a day-to-day basis is, I think that the future of real estate, in my opinion, of course, is that real estate agents are underwriters. They're not salespeople. They are salespeople, and everyone focuses on that. Like, sales. And all these coaches, and all I talk about are sales. And, like, do you know, have scripts or, you know, do this. And, you know, the old proverbial, and you're going to beat me out, you know, throw enough shit against the wall. But there's more to it. I think that a real estate agent is classically an underwriter. And what I mean by an underwriter is that it goes back to the financial business. A real estate agent should be the person that protects one of the most important assets. And this is nationally, that somebody enters. Nationally, people buy a piece of real estate, you know. It is one of the most important decisions that they make. They have expectations of the real estate agent to be professional and to understand those values and where those values are going and how those values. So what I do is I constantly strive to give them information that's relevant to that process. I want to be more akin to a Merrill Lynch than I want to be to call the banker. I've always directed us to be a brokerage in the traditional sense of associated with like a financial concern. That was a basic tenet of what I did when I came in here 8 years ago. And I continue to pursue that and continue to give them information resources and sit down with them and talk about that. The first thing I say to an agent when they come in and I coach them, I say, what do you read every day? what are you reading? And it's amazing to me how few of them read the Wall Street Journal. Now, I can tell you, you can get a doctoral degree in economics, finance, and all sorts of other financial concerns, as well as being up to date in the news or reading the Wall Street Journal every day. That paper should be the first thing that an agent goes to in the morning. And they will be up to date on what's happening and what's in fact affecting their lives, their clients' lives, and their houses, and the equity in their houses. If they understand that and they're up to date, they're light years ahead of their competitors, because that's what people want you to do. So I think that the brokerage business is not doing what's necessary. Brokerage business focuses on recruiting, you know, recruit. The brokerage business focuses on sales. Oh, we have this and we have that and we have this and we have that. But what they're failing to understand is, what does the consumer want? Is it not interesting to note that what, did Zillow's earnings just come out? I mean, it was like massive losses in Zillow, which is, you know, there's a disruptor business because they are giving information, you know, nationally, even internationally to clients. But what do they fail in? And of course, it's my opinion before I get sued by Zillow. They fail in information. Think about it. The Zestimate, it doesn't work, right? We can all agree with that. And how many people have been aggravated. We can all agree with that. It works. Their algorithms work when it's like, you know, unit A, unit B, unit C, and maybe more effective in certain cities where apartments are being sold and there's more effective, you know, more commoditization of the real estate business. So, I mean, there's a classic example of a disruptor that's failing to make money because they're not doing what's necessary, which is information resource to really assess valuation. And so another thing that brokerages don't do, which fascinates me, is they don't talk about the real estate business being an outlier. The entire business is built on outliers. You know, I don't care where you sell real estate, because everyone goes to the comps, okay? Even the mortgage industry goes to the comps. What did it sell for? How much per square foot? You know, here I love the line, people go to, like, how much frontage do you have on the ocean? You know, and they have calculations. There's all these funny calculations, you know, that, like, make it somewhat of a science. But what really is it? It's a business of outliers. It's a business of outliers because everybody on the sales side wants the top comp, whatever it is that they see. And it's a business of outliers because the buyers always want the bottom comp because they see whatever sold for the least. And no one ever delves into why did that happen. That's more important, don't you think? Why did that occur? And so we talk about that in our coaching. Like, how do you talk to your clients? How do you translate those comp concepts into appropriate pricing strategies for your client so that you can put the house on the price to have a transaction, to earn your living, to make it a successful transaction? So, like, I don't see people talking about this. And, you know, what's interesting is, does anyone talk about how do comps occur? Do you find it somewhat ironic? Like, what, do they materialize out of thin air? I mean, does anyone ever look at market mechanics? There's actually a market. So there's always an outlier on as the market's going up. But really, what's happening? I mean, there are more buyers than sellers, folks. And the market goes up, okay? And there are more sellers than buyers. Then the market goes down. Simply put, and all the external factors are interacting with that concept. News, politics, interest rates, fundamentals such as whether or not banks are loaning, even if the interest rate's low. I mean, we've gone through this period of time where the fundamentals changed dramatically with banking that people really couldn't get loans. I live in an area which is fascinating to me, not to go on a tangent here, but, you know, everyone says it's cash. Now, I think this is an interesting statistic to me, that if you look in North America, and this is something Mellon Bank put out, how much cash is there? You know, how many families are worth over $30 million? I forget what the number was in 2015. It was like 64,000 families in North America. That's 700 million people. That's Canada, United States, and Mexico. So 64,000 people have over $30 million in assets. Well, they all live here? So something's going on, all right? There's leverage in the marketplace. So cash is cash? Where is the cash coming from? My opinion is cash is coming from other areas that they're borrowing against because they couldn't get loans. And so I think there's going to be a real change in the dynamics in some of these trade areas that are more expensive as far as jumbo loans. I think that people who are borrowing from their assets, for example, are literally on day-by-day interest rate function, you know what I mean, based on LIBOR. So as interest rates go up, so it should be really fascinating what occurs. I'm sorry to go on all these tangents. Excuse me.
Yeah, no, it's cool. Mike, have you noticed over the last 18, 24 months or so, like I remember in 2009, 10, I remember hearing about, I didn't have any firsthand experience, but I remember hearing about a lot of foreign money coming into like cities like Miami and New York and, you know, the California's as a safe haven and also as like a dollar arbitrage play possibly. So even if the dollar had strengthened up, which it eventually did since that point in time, they would have been able to sell at a break-even number here and still have had made money and or just a safe parking place for the cash. Did you notice that dynamic? Has that dynamic changed? And have you started to see a little bit of a different buying clientele over the last couple of years in your trade area there in Newport Beach?
Yes, I'd say that, you know, I think it, my, of course, my opinion, it was safe haven assets leaving certain areas of the world. The people felt safe here and they wanted a place to come. They wanted to educate their children. I think that was really the biggest motivation. I think they also felt that they were going to make money in the long run, and they felt, you know, but I think that was really ultimately the response. I think that, I don't think it was like a quick concept of, you know, we're going to make money and leave. I think they wanted an entry point into the U.S. So that's what I saw here. And yes, it changes by what those countries do for capital flight. So if they change the dynamics of their legal, what they can or can't do, we see changes in those dynamics. You know, we've had giant deals in the past that, you know, $30 million, a deal was effectively canceled. Not canceled, the guy just lost his deposit because he couldn't get his money out of a foreign country because the government didn't allow it. So, and that law or whatever was the rule had changed during the escrow period. So, yeah, we see this constantly. And so, I mean, taxation and legal and immigration always play a role on what is happening. So, you know, with the existing political situation, I can't answer that. It's too early to see what happens with if it's going to be capital flight or not. Obviously, the dollar is up significantly against everything. So, I mean, clearly these people have made money. I don't know what the motivation at that point is. So, yes, we constantly, it evolves on a daily basis all the time. And this area is evolving constantly, too. There's more and more jobs, industry, creativity, for lack of a description, this area. So it's attracting a lot of foreign money as well. Hopefully that answers your question.
So, Mike, is there a single idea, system, or strategy that you have implemented, or it could be the company-wide implementation, over the last 12 to 24 months that caused exponential growth as a result?
I'd say it's not just one. I'd say it's all the things I've discussed strategically. And I think that most importantly, what people don't do is they don't listen to the marketplace. I always say this, and it's not my quote, multitude of quotes. You are ultimately paid for your creativity. And I find it so ironic that most companies or coaching, and that's why I'm different in what I do and what IOI coach, talk about all these people that have been successful, and this is what you do, and this is what you should follow. Like all these self-help books and all these things. I wrote a book, and I'm going to publish it shortly. And I just find it somewhat ironic. Like, all everyone talks about is, like, do this, because I did it. And, you know, they hold, you know, all these coaching companies hold up, you know, this great, you know, look at him, look at this guy. But what did he do, okay, to do that? And he was creative. He was doing something no one else was doing. We have a weird thing that we all do where we celebrate the creative person after the success has occurred rather than during the process. We push down creativity and say to people who are being creative or different that, like, oh, you can't do it that way. And as soon as it works, like, you're a genius. One of the classic people in history is Steve Jobs. You know, how many times have you been told, you know, you're an idiot? And meanwhile, he not only was he a visionary, he changed the planet 20 times over. You know, that's a huge loss to this world that he passed away. So I coach people in talking about their creativity, their genius, what do they do, how are they different, what have they been successful with, how to do that. It's individual. This is an individual, real estate is an individual sport. And it is important to stress that when you're helping people or when they become teams or when they do that, they are individual in their style and capability, and also that they're armed to the teeth with differentiations to be professional, to have all that information, and to beat out their competitors to get the listing. It's still a listing business. No matter what, it's a listing business. I love people who, say, I love being a buyer's agent. I mean, well, I don't know about anyone else in the business, but there's an awful lot of buyers to sift through to be a buyer's agent versus having the entire planet work for you with a listing. So, I also think you can't exercise your capability unless you have a listing. I mean, you really are really learning how to do everything that way. So that's what I would say is ultimately what we do differently. It's celebrate the individual, celebrate the creativity, coach better than everybody else, form teams better than everyone else, and give them all the tools necessary to beat their competitors so that there's no way to say no. They walk into a house and they got the listing before they even open their mouth. Wouldn't that be great?
Because you're from a stock trading background, I'm going to change the way I normally ask this question. So I normally ask, who would you identify as being the most successful real estate investor or developer? I'm going to change it a bit, and I'm going to allow you, if you would like, to just include investor of any kind of security or investment in your answer if you so choose. And you could also just kind of define for me why they're successful, Mike.
There's two ways to look at this. One would be the obvious answer in saying that Warren Buffett is probably the most successful investor in history, even in real estate and everything. And simply put, he had a formula that he stuck with, which is fundamentally, where was your value? And he was a trader at heart, and he bought when things were not priced correctly. He saw aberrations in the marketplace, and he made a decision to buy on almost like a gut level, not necessarily scientific. So that's like the obvious answer. But I do think that ultimately the people that are entrepreneurs and invest in their business, and there's too many to count, and take their time and take their creativity and really create something, that's really what investment is to me. And invest your human capital and to get the reward of human capital coming out of that. There's nothing I get more pleasure out of than seeing people reach their goals. It's tremendous, tremendous pleasure. It's really what I consider ultimate success. So that's who I think is the ultimate investor, those people who take those risks and really, go into a business that way. I don't know if I'm answering your question that way, but there are plenty of traders who are classic investors. Bill Gross is a client of the company, for example. He's a super genius in regarding trading. He's obviously majorly successful, even in real estate investing. But it's a different kind of investment, if you will.
Yeah, that's a great point. I really like that you point that out. I myself have had, recent good couple years since the crash. I went broke during the crash myself. And I've developed my investment in my marketing systems and the creativity that you're describing. And I can find no better place to put my investment capital than back into the marketing machines, which I've developed over the last 4 or 5 years. So that's pretty cool that you're defining that as success. Mike, 2 or 3 book recommendations you've made most often to people in business.
I'm a big fan of history. I personally like Bill O'Reilly's books. I've read all of them, Killing Reagan, all of the things that he writes about, I think with Martin Dugal, if I have that correctly. And he just takes the leaders in history and he really delves into what they did and how they did it. So I would say start with some of the first books that he wrote and go through it. I think what history is better than business books is because humans create business, emotions, the psychology. That's ultimately what business is human interaction, with a product or, I'm getting to this. So if you have a base knowledge in history and what someone did and how they did it and how did people react to it, you'll be better equipped in business. There are so many, Todd's in the room with me, and he is obviously has an advanced degree in economics, but he can study a multitude of, economic theories over, centuries. And it's amazing how not one is going to say, they all prove out and they all don't prove out. But what's fundamentally the same always is, you know, historical business behavior associated with leadership in history. Is that clear? I don't want to go off on a tangent that's not being clear. I do think that that's the most important thing to understand: how people are motivated, why people are motivated, what changes history, why did history change? And I think that is what prepares you for business. I mean, we're going through something now. I mean, there's a definite, clearly, you know, without even taking a stand what was right or wrong, I'm not going to do that. But clearly there's something that changed at the, and I think I've always said presidential elections are very much indicators of behavioral patterns for people. And I always look at presidential elections to sometimes guide me in marketing decisions and guide me in future performance, because what are people doing? What are they thinking? How are they responding? So I think that's important to look at. You know, there's obviously somewhat of a crisis in regarding what people are feeling and what they think the future should be and how it should be. And so that's something that should translate into your business. You need to be equipped to do that and translate that. So if there's a crisis going on, that's probably happening in the framework of your business as well. And what are people concerned about, and why are they concerned, and how do you help them through that process? So I think that's very important. I think that reading things outside the industry are probably the most pertinent things to the industry. And I don't understand why people don't talk about that. It's the most important thing. So that's my opinion, of course.
Nice. So if you could go back and share the crown jewel of wisdom, Mike, with your 18-year-old self, what would that be?
Oh, my God. It's like the greatest question in history. I probably would be less – I would probably say – and for me, it's worked out. I'm a risk taker of unbelievable proportions, and – sometimes I think people think it's almost sociopathic when I enter a new business. Like, I entered real estate business, I know what I was doing. And like, and now I run one of the larger companies in the United States. And so, you know, how'd you do that? You know, and I think a lot of it is that I just don't look at risk as a option. Like, it's like, okay, let's do it. Just moving forward. But I said, if I would give my 18-year-old self, because I've been that way my entire life, I would probably say, look at risks more closely, because you can minimize any stumbles along the way. And I think everyone stumbles. I've stumbled along the way. And so I think you're not always successful regardless, and everyone talks about that. But I would probably give myself that advice, you know, be more analysis. But then again, I wouldn't be here today, so it's hard to say. How would you answer that from that perspective?
That's interesting. You want to know my answer?
Yes, I'd love to hear your answer.
Don't get drunk. Yeah, had I put that away a little earlier, I think I would have cleared up and just had a lot less frustrations. That's just me personally.
That's great, yes. As my doctor always says to me, it's kind of funny, he says, it's a good drug.
Yeah, I guess it truly is a drug.
Right.
That's cool. So, Mike, if anyone's listening and would like to get some more information about you, would you like to share any contact information, websites, things of that nature?
Sure, absolutely. I'm happy to answer anybody. My email address is mshapiro, so that's mshapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O, at home group, just H-O-M, new word group, group.com. So there's no E on that home, so it's homgroup.com. I'm happy to answer emails, and they can look at our website, which is the same, homegroup.com. I love interaction, and I actually love to be challenged in my thoughts. One of the things that I love in regard to business is dissension. I love people yelling and screaming, and I do believe in chaos theory, I think. So I'm kind of funny like that. So don't any listener, please, if you don't like something I said or you want to contradict it, please feel free.
Cool, Mike. I appreciate you taking the time out of the day to share with our listeners here and share with me. I got a couple pages of notes and really cool, unique perspective on the real estate business. coming from the brokerage. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you as well. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you listening to me ramble on.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving a notification when I release the next episode? You can either sign up for email at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe through one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Do you have investment capital not currently earning a high rate of return? I recently opened up my business to a select group of private investors. Would you like to talk with me about potentially becoming one of those private investors? You can contact me directly by clicking the Contact Dan link at www.reidiamonds.com, and we can set up a time for a quick call. And if you are interested in selling a deal to me, visit www.reidiamonds.com and click the link at the top of the page. I'm currently looking for deals in Philadelphia, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, Chicago, Atlanta, Georgia, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. And finally, if you are enjoying the show and know somebody else who might also enjoy the show, I'm going to ask that you forward this email to them. I appreciate the referrals, and I appreciate you, my loyal REI Diamond Show listener. Dan Breslin here. I will catch you on the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.